Thank you. Thank you very much. I wanted to just say, first of all, that I have a hearing problem and that I lost hearing in my right ear a long time ago. And that means that I can't tell how loudly I'm speaking. So it usually is a problem not speaking loudly enough, sometimes the reverse. If any of you has a problem, please interrupt me and let me know. I'm also going to do a kind of unusual practice for me in that this is really a project of my dear colleagues and comrades in Greece that I have participated in a certain way that I'll describe. So I basically want to give credit to them, Elias Cornelis, who's the lead author. Elias is a psychiatrist who's currently a postdoctoral fellow in London and very active in Greece in efforts to expose and resist the policies of austerity that we'll talk about. And also my dear friend Alexis Benos. Now, what I'm going to do, Alexis is actually a professor of internal and community medicine at Aristotle University in Thessaloniki, Greece. And I know him through basically our work in international solidarity efforts, especially through the International Association of Health Policy and the Latin American Association of Social Medicine. And the sequence of events was, I have these relationships previously with Alexis. After the publication of my book that Fabian mentioned, Medicine and Public Health at the End of Empire, they thought that some of the themes, especially regarding the current crisis as reflections of the inherent weakness and fragility of the international capitalist economic system, was relevant to the situation in Greece. So they invited me to give some talks and to work with them there. And when they did this research, they actually asked me to contribute to them as an attempt to foster basically using my English speaking and writing skills, my editorial skills that I developed as a high school newspaper editor, to help them write this up. And so this actually led to a publication in AJPH several months ago that I'm going to expand on a little bit today. I'm doing it this way because Elias prepared a text that I'm going to either read from or paraphrase from. Before I do, I wanted to just put this into context by asking, does anybody have a clear idea of what is the problem in Greece and in general in Southern Europe that's led to the austerity policies? Does anybody here have a crystal clear idea of that?
Kind of, sort of.
Well, I'm from originally from Argentina, so we've experienced the blessings of IMF policies and foreign debt. And when you have to pay back your debt in a currency that is not yours, well, you're out of luck. So that's what happened to the Greek. I mean, the right, essentially.
But why is debt a problem? The problem, for instance, in Argentina was accumulating too much debt at the request of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, and actually, you know, quite a few years ago now, Argentina pretty much renounced its debt and renounced the neoliberal policies of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. So if those institutions were encouraging debt in the past, what's the problem now?
So they were, in fact, encouraging, I mean, I don't know about Greece, but what I've been able to read was very similar to what happened to us. So as they encourage debt, of course, they then socialize the debt when the debt was not couldn't be paid, and to actually force us to take loans to pay back the debt. Otherwise, you can't get grants. We can't get loans in the international market. Then they force you to implement the economic policies that are actually favorable to privatization, liberalization, and so forth, and capital to the detriment of workers.
Okay, so amazingly enough, what this crisis seems to reflect, and if anybody else has any bright ideas, let me know, because it's really confusing. For 30 plus years, since the Washington Consensus in 1980, and even before that, the policies were to encourage debt as a way to lead to economic development, supposedly. Policies that led to debt peonage in many countries, like Argentina, where half of the GDP was involved in repaying the debt. And it's led to a movement to renounce the debt for that reason. So what's the problem with the debt? Does anybody else have any? We thought debt was good, wasn't it? Okay, so the internet has been bad for the countries receiving loans, but it's been good for the banks essentially giving the loans. They made huge amounts of money, especially when those debts are sold to private investors. So what's the deal here? As of 2009, there was a 180 degree reversal in policy. And why? Well, the story is yet to be told in its nuances, but it needs to be told because, in my opinion and numerous others now, this was a reversal in terms of the social construction of a crisis that was created by the same institutions that are now demanding a reversal in policy that's leading to enormous suffering. And as was pointed out in the last talk, and in much other research, tremendous suffering, early death, and increase in morbidity and mortality. So one key point of this was financialization as a reason to accumulate capital. And basically what happened is that with the crash of 2008, the banks that were actually owning the debt were into huge crisis and then needed an influx of cash, essentially. And so what previously was an advantage now became a problem, and the debt crisis seems to have been created in order to answer the crisis of the banking institutions involved, not because there was anything inherently wrong with the debt. And just to put that in a little context, what is the country in the world with the highest proportion of debt relative to gross domestic product? The U.S. is close to the top, but what's the country at the top? Japan. Now, have we heard anything about Japan? Why is that? Because even though Japan has 225% debt relative to GDP, Japan holds 20% of the U.S. debt, which shows how bizarre this construction of reality is. And so we're not going to go after Japan, we're going after the countries that hold less of our debt. Now, there was a key intellectual product that justified this transition, which was an article that was published in 2009 by two economists at Harvard, Reinhardt and Rogoff. They claimed to show, through this empirical study, that 90% of the GDP and above devoted to debt leads to lower growth rates. And this study has been used as a scientific rationale for this draconian austerity policy that's been implemented, especially in Southern Europe. However, it turns out that when economists at UMass, Department of Economics, more oriented toward political economy. There was a graduate student who requested the original data for that study and showed conclusively that the spreadsheet that they based that article on contained multiple errors, including misclassifications of numerous countries like New Zealand. When it was reanalyzed, correcting those errors, there was actually no relationship between debt and growth, which has been a finding for the last 30 years, that there's no relationship, actually. Nonetheless, the international financial institutions, Germany, and led by Germany in particular, as kind of a surrogate for the United States, is continuing to implement these debt-creating policies. And if you want to read more, you know, about the impacts more generally of austerity problems, there's been a recent book by David Stuckler at Oxford and Sanjay Basu at Stanford called The Body Economic, Why Austerity Kills, basic books a few months ago. It reviews not only the Greek case, but numerous other cases. So in the, what, 8 minutes that remains?
I lost count. 10 minutes.
Okay. Now, so with that, I felt it was important to give that context. Now, if any of you has any information or knowledge that contradicts what I just said, I'd really like to hear it. Because I have searched for some scientific evidence of these backing up these draconian policies and failed, except for this one article that's been now debunked. So please inform me if you think I'm wrong about this analysis.
Are they recapitalizing themselves, Howard? Is that what's going on?
Yeah, that's essentially using
about a week to get the money they need to recapitalize.
Exactly. They're using the, you know, the payments on this debt to recapitalize banking institutions that have suffered as a result of the burst bubble of 2008. That's the best I can figure out. So pretty pathetic.
Do we move on with the fight? Do we move on with the fight?
Yes.
Which one? You will you tell me no? Okay. Okay. Oh, okay. The yes.
Yeah.
Reinhardt. Okay. The economic crisis. The paper. Okay.
Go back to the okay. So, next one. So obviously no financial relationships with this.
These banks. Or against them.
Somehow I've missed my opportunities here. Okay, so slide three. The Greek saga actually started in November 2009 with the internal and external talks about so-called Greek statistics. The whole discussion was triggered by the newly elected government's decision to revise upwardly the estimates of Greek fiscal deficits, which includes fiscal deficits of the wider public sector. So basically, there was a six-month period of escalating crisis of confidence regarding Greece's ability to meet its debt obligations. And this led up in April 2010, when private capital markets ceased to fund Greece's debt. A few weeks later, the Greek government and the Troika, which referred to the three major international financial institutions led by the World Bank, agreed on a program of economic and financial policies in order to finance Greece's external debt and satisfy creditors, mainly French and German private banks. And that's, Jonathan, the key issue here. So next slide. The origins of the Greek crisis. So the origin of the Greek crisis is highly debatable. The mainstream interpretation is based on the so-called twin deficits hypothesis. One, increased government deficit due to uncontrolled government spending, and increased trade deficit due to weak competitiveness as a result of high labor costs, led to a ballooned public external debt. This high public debt, according to Reinhardt and Rogoff, this is, again, the text of Elias, essentially caused the recession from this point of view. Next slide. Of course, this mainstream analysis has been questioned by economists. For example, it's argued that public debt increase is a symptom rather than the cause of the crisis, that the public deficit and debt started rising only when the economy came to a stop and not the other way around. Next slide, 6, I believe. So in this slide, Greece actually had long periods of deficits and debt, but was nevertheless able to finance them adequately in this period. Either via internal or external borrowing without serious problems. So this argues that public deficits in Greece are the result of declining state revenues, reflecting government's inability and unwillingness to collect taxes from high-income brackets of the population. A loss of competitiveness is a result of unbalanced economic relationships. This is basically the imperialist exploitation thesis between the Eurozone core in the north and the periphery in the south that produced deficits for the south and mirrored surpluses for the north. Next, even if one accepts the Greek or South disease, as it's called, argument, it's true that the problem was aggravated by the Eurozone's lack of central government. The Eurozone didn't fulfill its role as the European Central Bank, didn't fulfill its role as a central bank, and left member states exposed to financial markets. They therefore conclude that Greece's crisis isn't a sovereign debt crisis due to Greece's particularities, but a symptom of the global structural capitalist crisis. And after looking into it at great length, that's pretty much the convincing argument for me. That's a reflection of the global structural economic crisis. In May of 2010, the Greek government signed a loan agreement as 110 billion euros. The installments of the loan were delivered quarterly under the condition the government would implement a series of policy measures that included austerity measures worth 25 billion euros until 2014 and several structural reform measures. In March of 2012, yet another loan arrangement of 130 billion euros was put forward, and the program was extended until 2016. The austerity measures that the government willingly accepted to implement were significantly upwardly revised. Instead of 25 billion euros, the government would deliver savings worth 65 billion euros by 2016. So now, what are the Greek economic austerity programs and healthcare? Well, from the beginning of the program, healthcare reform was considered a crucial component of Greece's fiscal consolidation. An ongoing research in Greece has revealed that the memoranda of agreements that the Greek government signed with the Troika between 2010 and 2013 included 170 conditions related to healthcare. And these conditions included more than 40 different austerity measures in health, such as budget caps, new users' fees, a freeze on recruitment in the public health sector, reductions in healthcare benefit packages, and reductions, most importantly, in health personnel's wages, with massive reductions in salaries for health professionals. 60 different measures on healthcare reform that consist of establishment of an internal regulated healthcare market through the unification of Social Security funds into one single public health fund. And most particularly, the deregulation of entry requirements for private providers, in particular, private multinational corporations, managed care corporations, that are now selling their products in the private sector, and the harmonization of reimbursement rules among public and private providers. And then there are 70 austerity measures limiting access to medications. That's nice. In order to meet these targets, the Greek delivered public health expenditure savings of $2 billion in 2010 and increasing billions each year subsequently. Next one, sorry. So the Greek government has to implement co-payment measures of 0.4 billion in 2014 compared to 2009. And these are basically co-payments that patients have to deliver and for their medications and contracted private services. So while the implementation of the attrition rule in public hospitals has resulted in the unplanned exodus of 4,000 public health workers from the Greek National Health Service in only 11 months of 2012. So massive unemployment among health workers, both clinically and in the public health sector. The social impact of the Greek economic adjustment program. So as Greece is now in the sixth year of recession and the fourth year of harsh austerity measures, all socioeconomic conditions of the Greek population show clear deteriorating trends. And this slide shows, if you look at the labels underneath, that the unemployed program in late 2012 reached a 25% level overall, so a quarter of the Greek population unemployed. 875,000 more than at the onset of the crisis. Long-term unemployment was 15% of the labor force. In 2011, 34 million, or 31% of the population, lived in households facing the risk of poverty and social exclusion. And in 2011, also, 28% of the population was declared living in conditions of severe material deprivation, that is, not being able to respond to basic needs such as paying their rent, keeping their home adequately warm, or eating a meal with meat or some other protein source every 2 days. Next, please. Now, this is about the Greek crisis and healthcare utilization trends. So the demand for public health services in Greece has increased sharply during the years of the crisis. Patients discharged from public hospitals increased 36% between 2008 and 2012. On the contrary, patients visiting private outpatient departments in public hospitals decreased by 29% during the same period, reflecting households' inability to pay for services. And I just wanted to add to what Nadia struck, that what this means is, with a shift for people being able to use private services as a result of their Social Security benefits, the public sector is now picking up the slack despite drastic reductions in public support financially for the public sector. Next, please. So this increased demand for public services combined with households' drop of income and austerity measures that limit public service leads to increased demand inevitably resulted in the increase of unmet healthcare needs, which this slide shows. Between 2010 and 2011, people self-reporting unmet needs rose by 50%. So then the next slide. The impacts of the economic adjustment programs in regards to health. This slide shows infant mortality, which after a long period of decline has now started to increase drastically over the last 4 years by 51%. Next slide. This is a slide about suicide and homicide mortality, which have increased by 11.5 and 40% respectively between 2007 and 2010. And in the male population aged below 65 years, a group, as was pointed out by the previous speaker, heavily affected by unemployment, the relevant increases are far more intense. For instance, an earlier study of suicide and homicide, as well as infectious disease, showed marked increases in the age range between 55 and 65. Next slide, please. And more recent analysis confirmed this trend. Between 2007 and 2010, the first period of austerity, the suicide rate for men aged 30 to 34 and 50 to 54 increased by 75% and 82% respectively. And by the way, I could add that suicide is becoming increasingly common and much publicized. Recently in Greece, there's been suicide of a prominent pharmacist who lost his pension and committed suicide basically as an act of protest, as well as a national woman journalist on one of the main national news shows that local who lost her job and then also committed suicide as an act of protest. Next slide. So in terms of morbidity, there have been sharp increases in mental disorders, substance abuse, and even infectious disease incidents. Three cross-sectional studies showed that the prevalence of major depression and suicidality increased by 2.5% during this time period. Next one. The number of persons with problematic drug use rose by 11.6%, and in the age range of 35 to 64, there was a relative increase of 88.6% in drug abuse in that particular age range. Next slide. Most surprisingly, Greece has actually faced a growing epidemic of HIV infection as a result of austerity measures. The newly diagnosed cases of HIV rose by 57.2% between 2010 and 11. And in the case of intravenous drug users, the relevant increase was 1,500%. And this is attributed directly to the sharp decrease in freely distributed condoms and needles to intravenous drug users because of the dismantling of public preventive services. So next, in conclusion, why don't you go on to the next section? Evidence from the Greek experience is overwhelming. Capitalist crisis and neoclassical adjustment programs constitute a lethal combination, a twin threat for Europe's population's health. International funding organizations and national governments continue to disregard this evidence. Greece from 2010 to 2014 will be implementing austerity measures in health worth $20 billion. The interest payments that Greece will be paying during the same period are worth another 21 billion euros. It is for the people of Europe to decide whether they are willing to sacrifice their access to health care or even their health in the name of, quote, corporate competitiveness, unquote, and, quote, debt repayment, unquote. And I just wanted to show these last few four slides that will be a sense. This one is a solidarity clinic at Thessaloniki. Basically, he, Alexis, and dozens of other health professionals are organizing basically free clinics on their own time in the face of salary cuts or unemployment for doctors to provide services for patients who can no longer access them. Next one, please. Photos of the movement against inflammation, user charges in public hospitals, which is part of the austerity program. Next, please. These are photos of the movement against the downsizing and closure of public hospitals. And the last one, please.
That's it.
Okay, so that's it. So, again, I just urge your attention. This is a problem that's affecting people's lives and deaths on a day-to-day basis in Southern Europe and to a growing extent in other countries, even the United States, where we're seeing what I call neoliberalism coming home to roost in the present round of tremendously damaging austerity programs that are being initiated. So thank you very much. I'm
How about the other speakers coming over? So we have you guys sit here, and people are welcome to ask questions or make comments. Any questions? Yes, there in the back.
So it's an interesting thing how they, this can be ignored, but they talk all they want about the data, but they're still going to do it. They ignore the data, as you point out. In addition, they have the fascist groups in Greece that are also rising up, some fight against that. I think the Greek people are, though, taking it into the streets and doing something. It seems to me APHA can take a stand on some level. They're reluctant in many cases to take a stand on a controversial, both controversial things, but it seems to me that we ought to be in solidarity with the Greeks and other Italy, Portugal, Spain are experiencing similar things. This is outrageous, and we shouldn't just sit there, but it's hard. We have to work and go, pay our bills, but sometimes we have to go beyond that. So I'm wondering any thoughts about ATHA's role in this.
Well, I wanted to comment on your observation of the ethical failures of the banking industry, let's say, to put it mildly. I had an interesting experience being invited to Colombia a couple of weeks ago in relationship to my recent book, that there actually is a very important publication there in Spanish, essentially analyzing the role of bankers and financiers as war criminals. And that is a kind of surprising vernacular, but when you look at the actual death and devastation being created by these policies that are based on fiction, you have to actually stretch your thinking to include them. I would strongly support efforts by APHA. Unfortunately, over the years, as we've seen, the APHA resolution process tends to be a tempest in the teapot for the most part because of the lack of social movement connected to those resolutions. And I think beyond the APHA, we really have to find ways through our activism locally and nationally and internationally to push the resistance to this. And it's not without precedent. The case of Argentina is really a wonderful example. South Korea is another somewhat more problematic example, but we're seeing it now in multiple other countries, basically all over Latin America, of countries refusing to accept the given wisdom based on the ideology of the free marketplace. And competitiveness and the importance of these failed, even from the standpoint of the economists who developed them, now Stiglitz and multiple other economists who were responsible for these policies are now coming out and saying that they not only didn't work, but they caused great harm. So you can see I kind of get worked up about this. Encourage all of us really to take whatever actions we can to call attention to these problems and resist them.
Other comments, questions?
Yes,
do you want to say a little bit more about the comment about the right, the contribution this is making to the growth of the far right movement and the different but very real threat that poses internationally?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, and this may be part of the conscious motivation for the social construction of the policies, because what happens is that you create a fiction blaming the problem on policies that are humanitarian, that are supportive of population health, they're supportive of mental health, they're supportive of education, they're supportive of food policies, housing policies, etc. You create a construction that these problems are, that these socially supportive policies are at the crux of a crisis that's created. And what that does is it foments a right-wing reaction to those policies.
Can you do something like this?
All of a sudden.
So the resurgence of and support for right wing principles, we see that as we speak in the United States as well. You know, finding a whipping boy, laying the problem on, that then creates a basis for even more drastic and often violent resistance to these humanitarian policies that have been put into place.
Then you also had this reaction from the American public that we have to pay when we go to the doctor, what's wrong with them paying over here when they go to the doctor, or we don't have, you know, 6 weeks of vacation, we don't have retirement age 55. So, I mean, there's not a, it's very hard for this, and I think it's been hard, I mean, we've seen it, that it's hard for a lot of the American public to be outraged by bringing free. And then you see the same thing with public pensions even in the United States, where the public people here have set of pensions in private sector, so private sector folks, I think they're more and more, they have less concern about the well-being of people that would be relying on public pensions, but it's even magnified when you get to Europe, especially Southern Europe.
Yeah, it's been my experience, frankly, that more is made in the media of the people in our country holding those views that actually exists, because the reality confronting the vast majority of the population, those of us who compose the 99%, to use the very important symbolism of the Occupy movement, is an increasing understanding that these same policies are doing us in as well. All you have to do is have unemployed workers in your practice to realize that that the old mythologies that are conveyed in the media as what the United States people actually hold actually is not held by many, many, many people. What proportions are clear because the surveys are clear. What was a, you know, a very interesting finding after the heyday of the Occupy movement is that surveys showed that, multiple surveys showed that between 60 and 70% of our population responded that they actually did view the situation as 99% and 1%. And from my standpoint, the Occupy movement is not dead as portrayed in the media. Actually, messages are important, actions are going on all over the country. As a result of the Occupy movement and the activism that that resulted. So again, there is what you described in terms of false consciousness being fomented by the construction of this and the way it goes through the media. But actually, the reality, I think, is not as oppositional as it's described.
I'm going to ask a question about her data. You're looking mainly at heart disease and stroke, and we watched Howard's data that was more about suicide, substance abuse, HIV, and I just wonder whether you, in your practice of looking at the heart stuff, looked at any of the sort of data that Howard was looking at that had more to do with the psychological impacts of unemployment and austerity than necessarily the physical.
I think one reason that I wanted to look specifically at heart attack and stroke, first of all, you know, these are conditions that could be brought about by, you know, sort of acute stressful events like losing your job. You know, it's something that you would expect to maybe see in the wake of, you know, an economic crisis. But it was also a choice because of this counter literature that shows that, you know, maybe recessions are actually good for your health. That really, they're just looking at an aggregate level, right? So they're either looking at total mortality or, you know, sort of a variety of indicators. And one of the few indicators that stands out from those studies as not, you know, improving during recession is suicide. Suicide is one that consistently is shown, you know, it goes up during recessions, right? And I think the work that our staff that you mentioned, it focuses a lot on suicide. What I wanted to get away from was some of the, I don't want to call it obvious, but, you know, some of the more obvious things, you know, kind of social problems that might increase during the time of a recession. So look at things that people don't normally think about, like, you know, the fact that heart disease and certain things that really affect, you know, a lot of people, the things that people can't just say, oh, well, you know, I don't do drugs, or, you know, I'm not going to become HIV affected, you know, things that would affect all of us, and see if actually, if we look at this in the right way, can we show that in fact, it has had these profound effects on people's health. And I think that relates back to even the first comment about, you know, kind of evidence and does evidence matter? I mean, in a sense, I actually go back and forth on this myself because there's some, you know, things we mentioned about sort of the social construction of a social problem anyway. You know, evidence gets used in all kinds of different ways. But what strikes me is how shocking it is that the evidence that economists generate is taken as like the word of God, you know. And even when they make these horrendous mistakes in their Excel spreadsheets, you know, in a sense, I don't worry as much about that because, frankly, you know, not that many people are going to land, you know, major policy recommendations are probably aren't going to come off of my presentation. But I think that that's unfortunate, you know, and I think that that is part of the problem is, you know, why is it that, you know, these economists can say, oh, debt is good and, you know, let's do it, and then everybody listens to them, and, you know, a whole conference full of, you know, people talk about the health harms of, you know, economic austerity measures of, various types of policies, and yet the media doesn't grab onto this. People don't need to listen. And so, you know, I think evidence can help, but maybe we need to do a better job of, you know, counter-marketing.
Could I just make a brief comment? Actually, several brief comments. One is that Elias, Alexis, and Greek colleagues are actually extending this work to chronic conditions like heart attacks and strokes, which the previous literature for it has been also very interesting to examine from the standpoint of what is science. There are issues about scientific veracity of the studies that show that recession helps. Harvey Brenner pointed out long ago that the whole issue there is the lag period that's used. If you vary the lag period, you can get results that show that, whereas in the micro, studies, it's unequivocally shown the deleterious nature of losing one's job. I mean, I experienced this all in my family when my dad lost his job at age 55. And I say it innumerable times on patients. Horrendous effects, both on mental health and physical health outcomes. So that's one comment. The other thing is, you know, about the importance of in terms of scientific production, publications, and so forth. I think we need to be aware that there's a way in which work gets used or not used for policy decisions based on the pre-existing ideological orientation of a politician. And there's no clearer case of this to me in recent history than Paul Ryan, our congressman from Wisconsin, the head of the House Finance Committee, whatever, the person who has spearheaded the austerity policies in the United States. In the context of that discussion, he actually held up the Reinhart-Robach article as saying unequivocal evidence that our overspending is hurting our economy and then justifying, you know, the massive austerity policies with sequestration and all the rest that we're seeing. Of course, when the article was refuted, he didn't get up and say, oh, I didn't mean to say it, et cetera. So they were just a comment about how work is.
The lights are on a timer, I think. I don't know what's going to
happen. Howard, I have a question. I was just wondering whether you could elaborate on the following. I'm thinking about, I have this thought. Greek was imposed, essentially, as you described it, loans, and then this manufacture of the crisis, and then the
then to pay back the debt incurred by those loans. And it seemed that what they, you know, they rebelled and so forth, but finally they got these technocrats, I don't know the exact details, but who decided, okay, this is what we're going to do, and they decided on these austerity policies. And in contrast, and I'm thinking of my own country, and I'm thinking also of Dilma's country, Venezuela, when we had an economic collapse of that magnitude back in 2001, or in Venezuela as a result of also liberal, but actually neoliberal economic policies, you know, privatization, liberalization, and so forth, what we had is the people rebelled en masse. And we had five presidents in the course of 1 month. All of them went, I mean, almost literally out the window. In fact, the last one went through the roof in a helicopter. So I picked the guy up, but otherwise he would have been just torn to pieces, bit literally by the masses. And then for the first time in many, many decades of neoliberal policies, we got kind of a sort of a, you know, left of center president in Venezuela, got a socialist government, no less, right? So could you elaborate on why, I mean, why those differences?
Well, I agree that it has a great deal to do with the social resistance that develops. Another way, though, that I feel is a very accurate way to view the technocrats. You're talking about the technocrats in Greece.
Yes, well, in Europe, right? They say, okay, we're going to put these folks are going to fix the mess.
Right.
Supposed mess, right?
So, you know, William Robinson, who is a sociologist now at UC Santa Barbara, has done, I feel, very important work on understanding what he calls the transnational capitalist class. This is a class that has emerged that transcends national boundaries and circulates around among nations, and basically represents the interests of the capitalist class in whatever country they happen to be. So, it's been true, for example, in Argentina and in Venezuela, that you have a cadre of technocrats representing the interests of the capitalist class internationally, and their ability to come to power actually depends on the political struggle at that time. So what happened in Greece is that not enough votes came out against the center-right government to resist the technocrats going in that direction. So instead of renouncing the debt, they proposed exactly what you described. So I think that it really has to do with an interaction of the level of struggle that exists at that moment of history and the level of power that's taken by the representatives of the capitalist class who are often in a technocratic role. We're not speaking from the economic interests, we're speaking from the science of economics, you know, which show that we have to, as Rogoff and Reinhardt said, fix the debt problem in order to resume our economic growth.
So the follow-up, is there a lesson for the U.S.? I mean, is there not enough mass rebellion against the, Democrat and Republican-led, actually, two-party-led corporate policies that we're getting, healthcare, education?
Well, in the United States, my views of that in a nutshell are that there are three problems. One is that there isn't an organizational basis, in particular a political party, that actually moves the level of struggle forward. In Greece, for instance, as we speak, the reason that there's this degree of massive resistance going on, and it was the case in Argentina and Venezuela, obviously, is that there's an organizational basis for that resistance. Now, what was happening, for instance, in the Occupy movement is that things were actually moving in that direction. It was like an anarchist approach, but suddenly it was at least an organizational framework that still exists to a large degree. But there are two other issues in terms, in addition to the lack of reaching that level of political struggle. One is hegemony, which is the way in which ideology leads to the acceptance of false consciousness by a large part of the population. So it's people basically being trained to believe in the given wisdom of the time, even though it's inaccurate. And by the way, I hope the first speakers clarify the word praxis in your organizational title, because you know that was actually a concept worked through by the same person who originated the idea of hegemony, Antonio Gramsci, who basically clarified that fascism, in this case in the Italian context, cannot be achieved through force alone. It has to be achieved through the acquiescence of the population, and that's done through hegemony. And in our country, that means the media. The media conveying what is reality at the time. The reason the Occupy movement doesn't exist is not because it doesn't exist, it's because the media defines it as not existing currently. And then finally, the third point about the United States is repression. So our history shows us with crystal clarity that there have been periods of incredibly strong resistance, repeating over time, you know. And what's happened in each period when the resistance leads to getting close to actually changing structural relations and achieving power in the society, brutal repression occurs through the police, through the army, through the FBI, through McCarthyism, etc. And so we have to keep that in mind also. We sometimes sell ourselves short, I think, in terms of why we haven't achieved more in a progressive direction in the United States. And one of the main reasons is each time we've come close, it's been brutally repressed. So that's it.
Thank you very much. Very helpful. I just want to ask a question.
Referring to the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights that was recently passed in California. New York and Hawaii actually passed legislation earlier in previous years, also protecting domestic workers so that if things like that do happen, they are entitled to overtime pay after they work 9 hours. Currently, the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights and the 2015 change to the Fair Labor Standards Act is not going to protect them from employer abuse, which is a really huge issue with domestic workers who are working in private households where there is no sort of accountability or oversight of what's happening between the employee and the employer. Some of them, the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights now allows them use of the kitchen, which before was not even acceptable, although they're working at home. So there's still a long way to go, but New York, Hawaii, and California have made the most progress on these issues so far.
So we can take a last question, and then
you guys. Oh, sure, yeah. So real quickly about sort of what a gentleman mentioned about praxis. One thing Connie always emphasizes is Gramsci theory, is almost mandatory training and reading for us when we join staff.
Even though Gramsci didn't invent praxis.
Right.
If you go up on our website, we actually break it down from the Catholic Church pedagogy to Marx forward, and even Star Trek.
Okay, we have a last question there at the back. Yes. Go ahead.
I wanted to ask about what organizing, I think the election, what organizing examples stick out in your
of the privileges that we have at the Praxis Project is supporting the work of local groups around the country who are doing exactly what you just said, and the analysis that a lot of the groups work from is the strengthening of the public sector and public institutions, one of those being public education. And so some of the groups that stick out to me, folks mentioned the Colonias up here, there's a group down there that has worked very hard through a participatory budgeting process to bring basically parts of the county, Hidalgo County, the Texas, Mexico border in Texas, basically bringing them onto the grid. This was swaths of communities in Hidalgo County that were did not have public lights, that did not have running water, sewerage, and so this is a huge public health fight, and they were able to use democratic principles of participatory budgeting in order to make this a priority and leverage recovery money from the Stimulus Act in order to integrate that as part of the budgeting process. Another example that I'm thinking about is a school in Los Angeles through the work of ICS that has been able to bring health services into the schools because these were kids that were coming into a high school that was unincorporated territory in Los Angeles and not having access to basic health care in their communities. And so the school and parents and the public worked with several community institutions to bring these healthcare services into the school. So those are some examples that at the local level, with participation with local government, community, parents, teachers, students.
I just
want to
know the question of maybe, something that is happening in California, including in my hospital. The hospital is hiring many nurses, temporary nurses, from all the country, pay very low wages. They don't give them the full benefit. And they are letting go the full-time person that we have been working for a long time. So what is your, do you know anything about that? Is this thing happening over here? Because now we have many temporary working from Alabama, all these states, but it's fine for me. We know there's no problem, but don't let me go.
It's a national problem, right? It's a national problem, and I think part of it comes from what Howard talked about earlier, this idea that the problem is labor, the cost of labor, as opposed to thinking of labor as a driver for the development, like as human development as important, as central to how our economy should work, this idea that we should exploit labor as a practice for development, right? And that's really, and that's whether it's nursing, whether it's even doctors, whether it's even less of a doctor. Basically, there's so many jobs that are at risk because it's a question of the fact that whatever we pay for labor is not considered, it's considered to be something that's much cut in order to develop. And I think that's the fundamental issue, and it feels like there's an opportunity for us to work together across sectors to really redefine how we understand the economy and how we understand what's important. In the old days, they would say, what people need, right? Or however that, over corporate greed, or whatever the new version of that is. But that is a phenomenon that we have to figure out. And I think we have an opportunity as public health practitioners to reframe it.